Technology. It's such a big part of our lives. It can be fun. It can be convenient, just like this podcast, which is why University of Missouri Healthcare is proud to support podcasting on KBIA. Technology can also save your life. That's why so many people turn to University of Missouri Healthcare. Its hospitals and clinics offer you the latest technology, plus a medical team whose skill and knowledge are unparalleled. You know technology makes everyday life a lot better. Well, it's true for your healthcare, too. University of Missouri Healthcare, the care you deserve from the team you trust.
Hello, and welcome to Under the Microscope, KBIA's weekly look into stories in science, health, and technology. I'm Raymond Tongakar. On today's show, we'll hear from the recipient of a prestigious scientific honor and talk about changes in the ethanol industry. The ethanol industry could see some new changes next year. According to the Environmental Protection Agency's Renewable Fuel Standard, at least 1 billion gallons of ethanol needs to be produced from non-food plant matter rather than grain in 2013. That's a goal that the industry may be unprepared to meet. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, with several plants in the works, this type of new ethanol is poised to hit the commercial market sometime in 2013.
About a decade ago, concerns about energy independence, greenhouse gas emissions, and the need to boost rural economies led Congress to launch policies in support of biofuels, corn ethanol most notably. But the idea was that, eventually, more of this U.S.-produced fuel would be cellulosic, derived from corn residue, wheat straw, or other biomass. And yet the EPA has had to radically reduce expectations because today there's not a single commercial-scale plant producing cellulosic ethanol. But that's about to change.
Can you see by the dawn's
at a ceremony in Nevada, Iowa, DuPont Industrial Biosciences celebrated construction of its first commercial cellulosic plant. DuPont expects it to come online in 2014, eventually producing 30 million gallons per year of ethanol from corn residue, or stover, leaves, husks, cobs. In a speech, President Jim Collins said the company overcame technological, economic, and supply chain challenges.
It's been an incredible journey, and one that we knew would require thinking differently. It would require not just invention, but new types of innovation. Not just cooperation, but new methods of collaboration.
Meanwhile, in southwest Kansas, Abengoa Bioenergy is about a year ahead of DuPont. Executive Vice President Chris Standley says in Hugoton, they've already put in roads, tanks, and some buildings.
It's really, really making progress, so we're quite pleased with the way things are taking shape.
Standley says Abengoa's feedstock includes corn stover, wheat straw, and sorghum stubble, and could eventually expand to switchgrass and even waste wood. POET DSM Advanced Biofuels also has a plant expected to begin production in late 2013 in Emmitsburg, Iowa. That company plans to produce cellulosic alongside grain ethanol. A few other plants are in the works around the country, but oil giant BP recently scrapped plans for one in Florida. Great uncertainty remains about the profitability of commercial-scale cellulosic. Iowa State University economist Dave Swenson says until now, no company has been willing to take the risk, even with government subsidies.
I'm going to assume that the federal subsidy is an important part of their potential profitability and that without it, that we wouldn't be seeing this.
Even with the new plants going up, Swenson points out that since the Renewable Fuel Standard was established, the country's energy portrait has changed, and not to the benefit of cellulosic.
It's topsy-turvy from what it was a decade ago.
He says energy independence no longer appears to rely so heavily on new biofuels because natural gas is playing a larger role than expected. For now, rural economies will get a boost from the new plants, but the long-term prognosis for cellulosic remains unclear. What's certain is that the industry will come nowhere near that 1 billion gallon goal for 2013. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
The American Association for the Advancement of Science is an international nonprofit organization that's been around since 1848. The goal of the organization is to advance science, engineering, and innovation globally. It publishes the prestigious journal Science, as well as several other scientific publications. Every year, the organization selects fellows based on their contributions to science. This year, the University of Missouri had six members of its faculty earn the esteemed honor. Stephen Alexander is a professor of biological sciences at MU and was one of the recipients. He sat down with KBIA's Alexandra Olgan to discuss his award and his research.
First of all, congratulations on getting this award and being a fellow. Can you tell me what it means to be a fellow?
Well, I think it's a very nice distinction. I was honored to be recognized by colleagues in the biological sciences. That indicates that the totality of your life's work is considered important by people in the field, and I couldn't be more thrilled to get this award.
Can you tell me a little bit about your research?
The primary problem we're interested in is why tumors become resistant to the drugs that are used to treat them. Specifically, about 15 years ago, we got interested in a drug called cisplatin, which is widely used to treat a variety of tumors. And in almost all the cases, tumors will ultimately become resistant to the drug. There had been a lot of work done on this drug, but there was quite a bit of confusion. And I had the idea that we could use genetics to sort some of this out. So we work on a simple organism we can do genetics on, and we got mutant lines that were resistant to the drug. And these allowed us to identify what genes were involved and what proteins were involved. And we sorted through this and found a couple novel enzymes that were involved in making cells resistant to the drug, and we followed up on one of these for the next 12 or 14 years.
So what are the real-world implications for someone who has cancer right now?
One of the things that we discovered was that we could sensitize cells to this drug using another drug. A tumor that might be resistant to cisplatin at a certain level is a real problem therapeutically because you can't raise the concentration of the drug you're using. But by using a secondary drug, we can make those tumors more sensitive to the first drug.
Is this currently being used?
There's no current use of this. But these things take a lot of time, very expensive to bring any drug to market, and the biochemistry is complicated.
Are certain people resistant to this kind of drug, or is it random?
Every tumor has a number of mutations which make it a tumor, make it grow faster. So that's the primary characteristic of a tumor cell, that it's growing faster than a normal cell. Having said that, these cells also tend to have what's called genomic instability. So their DNA gets broken up and mutated a bit faster than normal cells. The result of that is that more mutations accumulate, and some of those cause drug resistance. So it's a totally random process. It could happen early on. It can happen later. It might not happen at all.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I just want to say again that I'm very grateful for getting this award and just very, very happy that it came my way.
And that'll do it for this week's Under the Microscope. To hear this episode and listen to others, just check out our website, kbia.org. I'm Raymond Tungekar. Thanks for listening.